This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Place to Be Nation, welcome to episode number 8 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, of course, here in our Atlanta, Georgia offices, getting ready to deep dive into the outer rim of nostalgia that was the WCW mothership. And to do that, as always, I do need to bring in my partner here on the show, and that is the one and only chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you?
I'm good as always, JT. I'm excited to do this week's show. There's some cool questions going to come up. And I just want to clarify something from a previous episode when we discussed the WCW power plant. Do you remember when I kind of pitched the idea that Bobby Eaton would be a good trainer?
Yes.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I neglected to remember, or I forgot completely, to be fair, that he did have some sort of tryout to be a trainer in, I think, maybe Deep South or FCW about a decade ago, and he wasn't very good. He knows it all. Basically, what was explained to me was he knows it all himself, but he can't explain that to other people. So there is a skill in being a teacher in itself, and some people are just good at things, but they can't explain it. And I think Barry Windham's another guy like that as well. So that's really why you don't see him, you know, around any kind of training schools or anything, unfortunately.
Yeah, you get that a lot, like in baseball, too. Guys were great hitters, and they try and be hitting coaches, and they just fail at it because they can't. They just can't figure out how to teach someone to hit. It came so innate to them. So, yeah, it's definitely a truth. Like you said, there is something to being a great teacher beyond just someone that can perform or do the task in a great way.
Yeah, and on the other way, there's some fantastic teachers that weren't necessarily great wrestlers or in different sports as well. So they
like
don't
Buddy
always
Lee
go hand in hand.
There
we go. So, yeah, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. But, no Bobby Eaton, I don't think, at the Performance Center anytime soon.
All right. Well, why don't we get into our own Performance Center here tonight? We do have a great list of questions. We're going to dig deep, deep into that plunder bucket, Alan. And why don't you bust out question number one?
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Okay, here we go then with question number one. Hey, Alan and JT. I have vague memories of Jason Hervey's ubiquitous appearances on WCW TV and magazines circa 1991-ish. How and why did this happen? Was he simply there as an easy surrogate for the audience, given his age, or benefit from other connections as a celebrity fan? And that's from Dan Morgan, who sent that in via email. So thank you very much for the question, Dan. This is a good one. So Jason Hervey, do you want to explain to people who may not be familiar on who he actually is?
Yeah, he's a guy that gets by with a little help from his friends.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me?
As the song goes, of course, he was I don't think he's an actor anymore. He's more into the production side of the business. But, of course, most famous as being in the role of Wayne Arnold on The Wonder Years, I don't want to call it a sitcom, more like a family drama, I guess. There was some comedy mixed in there. 80s and 90s, it was I think it was a fairly big hit. I know it's well known. It had a decent length run of 88 to 93. So it was, it was a well-known show at the time. It was big at the time as far as, family settling down to watch. Like, I definitely remember watching this with my family. It looks like the highest it peaked was its third season at number 9, and it was always in the top 40-ish until it kind of hit the wall at the end. Of course, also featured Fred Savage as Kevin Arnold. He was the title character. And, it was a good show. I think Winnie Cooper, of course, may be someone that most people remember. That was Kevin's girlfriend, and she was quite fetching. So that was... That's the Wonder Years. And yes, Jason Hervey was probably the breakout. You know, there's always the main star, and then there's a breakout star of the guy that kind of gets himself over. That was, I think, Jason Hervey. This, he was the asshole older brother with a deep heart of gold, of course, but always treated his brother Kevin like an ass. So that was I'd say that was his primary role here. It was just kind of the asshole brother, and he kind of got over as being a heel on TV. And I think he was someone that many people, you know, in real life, or when he'd pop up, he kind of kept that angle up a lot of times, as we'll see. So he definitely played it up.
Oh, yeah. A few comments from me about the Wonder Years just before we get into the wrestling side of things. It aired over here in the UK on Channel 4. Fairly popular over here for years, like it was in the US as well. Family kind of drama-ish, some comedy moments in it. A couple of notes. I never liked the dad in it. I thought he was a horrible dad, and I was so glad I didn't have a dad like that. He was always moody.
But that did fit the era, right? Because it was set in, what, the
60s.
Yeah, 60s. I mean, that was kind of a 60s era American dad, I think. He played it well. So, I mean, I don't know if you were supposed to like him in some ways, but he was, you know, he was a tough dad. That was the role of a father back in the 60s, I think. So he, you know, he did it. Did it right.
And the person that went on to the biggest fame out of it wasn't, well, this, tongue in cheek, I'm saying this. Don't take this is real, but was Kevin Arnold's best friend, who was a guy called Paul.
Yes.
He went on to then be a massive platinum music artist, Marilyn Manson.
Yeah.
Well, that was the rumor for a number of years anyway, that they were one
that
of
was
the same,
an awesome, no. I remember that rumor. That was a tremendous rumor. Obviously, I think I think disproven at this point, but God, that would be something. Imagine if it was him. That'd be pretty funny.
Yeah. But yeah, getting onto the wrestling side of things with these links with WCW. It was earlier than 1991, Dan, than when he actually came in there, Danny asked the question. He was actually a judge at ringside during Clash 1, the Flair versus Sting draw. There was a number of different different judges there. There was Penthouse model Patty Mullen. There was Gary Juster. He was involved in WCW as a, I think he was one of the local promoters, booked a lot of the things like that. And we had Sandy Scott as well. So those three, one decided for Flair, one decided against for Sting, and one decided a draw. The other two people who were the judges that weren't actually, you know, asked about, I don't know why, they were announced before the crowd, was Jason Hervey and Ken Osmond, who's from Leave It to Beaver. Mm-hmm. So in the end, it was Flair got the draw. And that was, we didn't see him for a few months then, and he came back at Clash 4. He was the ring announcer for the Fantastics versus Ron Simmons and Eddie Gilbert match. The one thing that always struck me about Jason Hervey was how small he was. He was really short ass, wasn't he, JT?
Yeah, I think he always came off as a kid because of it. Like, even, you know, because we'll get to it, what he's kind of known for and what they bring into storyline in a few moments. But even then, it seemed like he was just like a little boy. Like, the whole thing seemed weird because he is so short. He just never seemed... it just never seemed like he was old enough. It just seemed like they had a kid there. And a fun fact for Leave It to Beaver, by the way, Jerry Mathers, who, of course, was in that show, was in the same army platoon as my father. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah.
Small world.
Right. So, he was short. He is, I don't know, 5 feet maybe. Maybe a little taller.
Yeah, very short. But I'm just going to go through what I found research-wise about it. I went to the Observer Archives and went through when he's been mentioned. So that was the best kind of way I could see a timeline of things here. So if it started here on January the 10th, 1991, Observer in the Global Wrestling Federation section, it was noted here that John Tatum did a television interview in reference to Missy Hyatt and Jason Hervey were in the building at the show in the cheap seat, since Hervey had a celebrity ice hockey game the next day in the area. So I think there was links there. John Tatum was previously married to Missy Hyatt.
Yes.
They had a relationship, and obviously Green Eyed Monster maybe seen Jason Hervey there with Missy Hyatt and had to reference it. I don't know if it was worked as an angle or what, but that's the kind of first mention of Jason Hervey in the Observer.
Right.
And then we go to March the 4th, and it says, speaking of Missy Hyatt, she was briefly on Friday night on Late Night with Richard Deeds with Jason Hervey, who introduced Hyatt as his new girlfriend. It's a shoot, even though I realize most of you reading this won't believe it.
All right, so Hervey was born in 1972. So he would have been, what, 19?
Yeah, he was 19 when he was dating her.
All right, and how old is Missy Hyatt?
So what year was he born? 1972, did you say?
Yeah, she was born in 63. So she would have been like 28. Well, all right.
Well,
I mean,
don't,
I know,
pat
it's
him on the back for that. You know, let's actually stop for a second and just admire how a 19-year-old managed to pull this one off.
19-year-old Jason fucking Midget Hervey is landing prime Missy Hyatt. Like, that's an all-time pull right there. That guy doesn't get enough credit for that. I know he, and like I said, he seemed super young at the time, but I thought maybe he was at least like in his early 20s and he just looked young. But God, he was 19. and he was able to land Missy Hyatt. And then there, you know, it mentions here the next one that they're engaged. Actually, no, I guess it was shot down. Originally, they said it was engaged, and then it was shot down. That's a little crazy, but it's yeah, that's nuts. That is nuts. A 19-year-old Jason Hervey is hooking up with 28-year-old Missy Hyatt at this point.
That is, you know, more than impressive. So yeah, I think I'm going to send him a tweet and congratulate him. All these years later, probably thinks, "Who the hell are you?" But I may do that anyway. But yeah, getting on to after this, then he was on May the 20th. Observer. It was noted there they had a new interview segment on WCW TV called "Bull Drop In" with Dusty Rhodes and Jason Hervey, which replaced the Danger Zone. Dusty may get TV ratings up, and he may not get house show attendances up. But there's one thing is certain: he will get Dusty Rhodes over. So These shows are something else, aren't they? I mean, I've put a couple on the playlist, JT. The one with the PN News ones especially. Do you want to just describe to people, I think you would have watched it yesterday or today, what your kind of takeaway from these segments are?
It wasn't awful. Like, I thought Dusty was pretty good in the role. I mean, obviously, he's a great talker. He was on the booking committee. He had just returned because he was in WWF in early 91. So, I mean, these are from, like, the summer of 91 into the fall. So he was up on everything. I thought the segments themselves when he was leading were pretty, you know, were fine. Like, he had the one with PN News, which I thought he helped get PN News over. And then he had the one with Arn Anderson, which I thought was really good too. So I thought the idea of it, besides the name and you know, just the general look of the show, was pretty effective. I didn't really get the tie-in with Jason Hervey. I don't really get why Hervey, and I know whatever the backstory is with Hervey and Dusty kind of knowing each other, but it just did, that was like a weird fit, and he felt like a little kid in those. Like, he felt like a 10-year-old just hanging out with Dusty in his little back room, you know. And it was just very odd. And you know, and the second one with Arn is when Paulie Dangerously comes out, and him and you know Hervey are going back and forth, and Hervey just had this wicked, like awful attempted burn on Dangerously, where Paulie's like, you know, what are you doing here? I'm doing whatever I want to do. You know, it was just like awful. It was such like a 91 Bart Simpson, you know, like just that era of like young teenage punk kind of answer. But yeah, I don't know. Was there a tie-in for you to see Jason Hervey with the cowboy hat hanging out in Dusty Rhodes' bunker for these interviews?
It was the dancing. It was the dancing that did me. I mean, if any, like it was said here on the June the 3rd Observer, as for the bull drop in, I just hope nobody in Hollywood who's important sees it, because it won't do wonders for Jason Hervey's career. Yeah, it was really bad. There was him and Dusty dancing and jiving to PN News' rap music, both with cowboy hats on. Jason Hervey looking about 2 foot shorter than both of them.
Oh,
it was
awful.
Just a sight to be seen. So yeah, it's on the playlist.
I mean,
guys,
I thought he was sitting at one point. I guess he was probably standing. It looked like he was sitting. But yeah, Dusty's like, can I do it? Yo, baby, yo. You know, and then he has this one great, I'll put the clip in the show as well in a moment here, but he had this one great like soliloquy where he steps back and he explains why he's not wrestling anymore. I think it's during the Arn one, and it is just fantastic. It's like classic Dusty. He's like, I had to step away to do my business. He just like is talking to himself. It's so random about why he's not wrestling anymore. But yeah, there's two on the playlist, PN News and Arn, and they are classics for sure.
And at this time, I would like to introduce to you one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, and he's my favorite wrestler, your host of the Bull Drop In, the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes!
Let me talk to my man. We're talking about the Wonder Years here now.
That's right.
We're talking about you being a bad guy on the Wonder Years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's my job. That's right.
That's your job. I'm going to tell you what. We're going to do it all here on the bull every week. We're going to shoot a little bull out here. We're going to talk a little bull out here. And we're going to get down and right for it. Let me ask you a question. Around WCW right now, it is hot and heavy with Sting and Nikita. Who are you going to pick in that thing, baby?
Well, let me tell you something. I would have to pick Nikita Koloff, because if anyone, listen to these people, it's obvious you don't know what you're talking about, because if you were to watch the workout tapes like I do, you would obviously see that he's the man to pick.
I tell you about it, I've been watching you, baby, and in the ring you can get it done. You got more moves than a bowl of Jell-O. They used to say that about me before I retired, step back from my business. Can I try one time?
Yeah, you go ahead.
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo!
Yo, baby, yo, baby, yo!
Yo, baby, yo!
So then next after this was his appearance on Clash 15 when he was invited onto the Danger Zone, Paulie Dangerously show, which was obviously maybe because he was doing the ball drop-in, which was taking over Dangerously on TV. So right. There was kind of a bit of a rivalry there. That's how it naturally would have been. But the whole thing came off as Paulie Dangerously as the heel to the fans live, just Joe Jacking. And then the segment basically ended of just a bit of Joe Jacking between the two with Paulie calling Missy Hyatt used merchandise. And Jason then walks off. Paulie then basically cracked him from behind with the phone and it flew up into pieces, which is quite, a good visual, to be fair. Dave noted here that the segment was pretty good, but when it was never referenced again for the rest of the show, it lost a lot of its effectiveness.
Right.
So that was basically... It's a cool little segment. I mean, I don't think it really did much apart from... I think the whole idea, which is mentioned on the Observers in the next month or two, was it was trying to lead to a match between Jason Hervey and Paulie Dangerously originally, which then ended up being Flair and Paulie Dangerously versus Missy Hyatt and Lex Luger managed by Jason Hervey, which luckily didn't happen. I don't know if they were going to do that for TV. I think it was mentioned it was going to be on the Omni, but right. Flair... by this point, had gone. Flair was fired from WCW, and that didn't actually happen, and it was kind of petered out at that point. So that was his real 1991 run. It was his that one appearance really on the Clash, which was the most famous thing from him.
Yeah, and it was a good spot. I mean, he took the bump pretty good, and it definitely had some heat. I mean, Hervey's tough because he's not super likable. So I don't know how into the fans would have been as him as the underdog against Dangerously. But it did eventually kind of transition to the Dangerously Missy angle, which then eventually became Dangerously Medusa. They were desperate to have Paulie against either a woman or a celebrity or something, because they kept going to the well until they found the one that worked, and that ends up being Paulie and Medusa. But yeah, Paulie and Missy does have, they do have a bit of a feud going on, and it looks like the Flair thing was going to be in L.A., and then the Paulie Hervey match was going to be at the Omni. And it seemed like neither happened. And it sounds like because they were close to filming the next season of Wonder Years, they had a cut. It sounds like that might have been why they didn't do the match with Jason getting in the ring, because they didn't want to, affect the TV filming or whatever, or cause any issues.
No, that makes sense. But the next kind of thing after that then was on September the 23rd edition of The Observer, it's reported that there's a TV commercial aired for Galoob Toys with Paulie Dangerously. And what basically happened was, Jason Hervey was suing WCW and Galoob because they didn't have Hervey or his agent's permission to use Hervey's likeness in the commercial. And basically all it was one of the clips that briefly aired in the background was one where Dangerously hit Hervey over the head with a telephone, and that was it. So he decided to sue WCW because of it, which was, makes me laugh when I found this one out. Because obviously he's linked with WCW for years to come, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, you always thought that he was tight with the promotion. It's weird that he would sue them over that. It's not like, I don't know. Just to show him getting knocked out. I mean, I could say maybe trying to get some royalties out of it, but suing and making them pull the ad felt a little bit strong. I mean, maybe he could have gotten another payday out of it instead, but it seemed like an odd turn. Maybe he was bitter about the match getting dropped or something, and this was his payback, but it seems like an odd return for a guy that's always linked, especially, more to come in the future as well.
Yeah, he turns up on a Nitro, in 99. He comes out and just randomly does commentary with Bischoff. He thought he was excellent throughout, and obviously no one else really did. He came across as a former child 2-bit actor, goes on television and doesn't really do much. That was his kind of one next appearance or last appearance in WCW 8 years after the 1991 quote-unquote run. But there was an interview with him, and he was asked how he kind of came about the WCW thing, which is quite interesting when I read this. And his answer was, I was friends with Dusty Rhodes. I did a series called Wild Side with Meg Ryan and Terry Funk for ABC. I was around, and he asked me if I wanted to get involved, and of course I was game to do it. In 1991, I met with Eric Bischoff and hit it off, and we've had our company, Bischoff Hervey, for years after. So that's how it kind of came about. But we were discussing off air why WCW would have really been linked to Hervey, and we noticed that they started airing syndicated on TBS Wonder Years things, but that wasn't really till 92, was it?
Right. Yeah, that was after he had already been on. I don't think that tie-in had anything to do with it. It sounds just like he was a wrestling fan, was friends with Dusty Rhodes, and maybe they just figured they could get some publicity out of him because he was a decently sized TV star at that point. He was well known. It seems like it was just kind of, they ran into each other and, why not? Like, he was a wrestling band. He wanted to be on TV. They said, let's put him out there. So, I mean, I don't think there was anything more to it than that, given that the syndication stuff came after.
The one thing that makes me laugh is when he was asked about the phone that hit him. I'm pretty sure, like Dave Meltzer reported, it was a gimmick phone. But when he was asked here, was the phone gimmicked at all? His answer was, nope, regular phone. I told him if it was the Wonder Years, I would have called for a stunt double or a prop phone. He was just like, you'll thank me later. It was not gimmick and was heavy as can be. I remember seeing black before I hit the canvas, not a gimmicked phone at all. Take that how you will.
And I'm curious how him and Bischoff became tight, if it was through ties to wrestling or if they met elsewhere. Because I know Bischoff was a big kind of Hollywood guy, you know, always trying to go out to L.A. and find different deals and get involved in that business, into production and whatnot. So I'm curious how they came to be and how they hooked up. And, you know, how much would a role of Jason Hervey would have had if Bischoff did end up buying WCW in 2001 with Fusion? Would, you know, their production company have been more involved? And I believe it's theirs that does that Hulk Hogan Championship Wrestling or whatever, right? Weren't they part of that? Or
yeah, they were involved in a couple of, like, Hogan vehicles in the noughties and, you know, and beyond. But, yeah, that's kind of Jason Hervey's run in wrestling, really. He did say as well that he worked for WCW all the way till the end, but by working for WCW, he never drew a paycheck, and he helped with some of the distribution of the special Turner releases. They did some, like, best of WCW ones in the late 90s, early 2000s. I don't know if you ever saw this. It was like Flair stood in the power plant with Tony Schiavone just remembering classic moments in WCW history, and they were like 45 minutes in length. They came out over here in the UK and they were really cheaply priced, something like £5-6, which would be, you know, not a lot of money really at all for VHS. Do you not remember them?
I don't remember those specifically. I do remember the cheap VHSs they pushed out around that time. They had like the Sting one, the Goldberg. Well, like you said, they were 45 minutes and really, really cheap, which seemed kind of off because WWF was starting to put out DVDs and, you know, more robust video offerings, and WCW was just kind of throwing out these junk tapes. But nothing touches, and maybe this will be a future topic if anyone wants to write in about it, the WCW All-Nighters, if you remember those. Those were a lot of fun, too. Kind of along the simmer. Did you get those over there?
No, we didn't get them over here. I picked them up via tape trading. They were, you know, available that way because they ran a 6-hour block. So the only place really that would air them is the home station, which was TBS during the night to fill some airtime. And they got really good ratings at the time, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, they did well. I mean, I don't know how it wouldn't, you know, especially for a station that was so tied into the promotion. And you're showing the best matches in the company history. And even the interludes are fun, where they'd have Tony, Bobby, Gene, whoever, they'd be like sitting in the basement, like in their pajamas, you know, just talking between the matches. It was a cool concept. It was pretty neat. At a time where, you know, nowadays you were like, well, whatever, we got a network, we got YouTube and all this other stuff. But at a time where footage and whatnot was not always like easily accessible, like it was, you know, like it is these days, it was kind of cool to have stuff like that where you could, you know, have a way to get a hold of these matches and whatnot.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully someone will ask that question about the All-Nighters so we can cover them, because it was, you know, they were cool shows. So shall we move on to question number two?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. So, dear JT and Alan, I remember the Cruiserweight title initially had a tournament. I haven't seen much footage about the tournament. Can you run through it? And that's from Wilkie in Apple Valley, Minnesota. So thank you very much for the question via email there, Wilkie. So the WCW Cruiserweight Championship Tournament, JT,
mm-hmm.
From looking here, because I thought this anyway, but I went to double check that it was a Phantom tournament. So do you want to tell people what a Phantom tournament is and what the actual only kind of matches were?
Yeah, Phantom tournament is one that never actually happened. You can think back to the old Rio de Janeiro Pat Patterson tournament. And we get another one here. The Cruiserweight title was christened in 1996. Of course, WCW was bringing in a lot of foreign talent and a lot of... He started to bring in the Cruiserweight-style wrestler in late 95 when Nitro started. So they decided to make a championship for them. There was the single match on Uncensored preview show, Dean Malenko, Mr. JL, and they said the finals would be held in Japan, and JL actually beat Dean Malenko in that match. And then in Japan, we also had – oh, why don't you talk about this one, Alan? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, well, that actual match that was said, it was for a first round for the Cruiserweight title, right, which was one of the Uncensored kind of prelim matches. Well, not even on an Uncensored. I think it was a main event before Uncensored. Yep. It was JL, like you said, beating Malenko, which they said was the first round matchup. But the actual final occurred, this is classic WCW, 3 days earlier for New Japan, where it was a WCW Cruiserweight title deciding match was Shinjiro Otani beat Wild Pegasus Chris Benoit to win the title. So that was really what happened. So, like we said, in classic WCW fashion, they weren't doing things in order, this, that, and the other. And then Otani was shown on WCW TV as the champion. I think he was doing some, like, a lot of worldwide shows.
Yes.
I think he came in for a set of tapings, you know, in a late March 93.
Was he at Starrcade too? Was he part of the 7-on-7?
Yeah.
He was, right? Okay.
Yeah. So the fans may have been familiar with him to a degree.
He fought, he fought Eddie. He defeated Eddie there.
Yeah, so that's the kind of history of it. There's not much really to it. And then it went on, and we were using more Mexican guys than the Japanese guys, really. You know, there's examples like there's Magnum Tokyo, Ultimo Dragon, you know, other guys that came in from time to time. Ultimo Dragon won the TV title as well. But, yeah, it was mainly Mexican guys were, you know, predominant guys in the kind of cruiserweight division, weren't they?
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that. And the title would, you know, it would hot potato at times, but in a good way. And they really did hold it in prestige for a while as well. Like, it was up there for the first couple of years that they looked at it before. It kind of becomes jokey later. But for a while, it was held up as a pretty high-ranking title in WCW. Like, they took care of it. They made sure it was featured on pay-per-view and TV in a good way. And Otani, I believe he only has it very briefly, right? In theory, yeah, he has it just until May 2nd when Malenko beat him on Worldwide. And that's, to me, that's when their cruiserweight title really starts to get into gear. Like, Otani, like you said, he's not Worldwide a bit, but they don't really talk about the title much. And then once Dean gets it and starts, you know, it starts going back between him and Ray and Ultimo Dragon throughout the rest of 96, like, that's when it becomes a really valued title. And Dean gets a lot of shine as champion in 96. He gets a lot of coverage. They have a pay-per-view, you know, match on every pay-per-view. It's heavily featured, and like I said, really all through, you know, even to 98 when you had Malenko and Chris Jericho fighting over it, and Kidman and Hoovy, and, you know, all these guys. It wasn't until really 99 when all the stuff with, like, Lenny Lane wins it, and then they strip him because they had a, you know, they didn't approve of the gimmick and all that stuff, and then you get into Medusa and Oklahoma and all that bullshit. So I would say for at least a good maybe 3 years, it was a well-regarded championship. That was really always, like, just really quick to list the guys who have held that title. And tell me, I mean, this is a pretty good list of guys. When you think of these types of titles, a lot of times they can get jokey and shit on pretty quickly. But after Otani, it's Malenko, Mysterio, Malenko, Dragon, Malenko, Six, Jericho, Alex Wright, Jericho, Eddie Guerrero, Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, Dragon, Guerrera, Mysterio, Jericho, Malenko, Jericho, Juventud, Guerrera, Billy Kidman, Guerrera again, Kidman, Ray, Psychosis, Ray. Like, I mean, that's... There are no jokes in there for 3 years, right?
No, not at all. And there was loads of other guys on the shows that were, you know, really talented. You had, even up until 99, we had, like, people like Blitzkrieg showing up. Was really good kind of Northern California worker that, you know, had a brief run in WCW, which I thought was excellent. Unfortunately, his career petered out. We didn't see much of him after that. But, yeah, WCW Cruiserweight title between 96 and 99 was fantastic. I mean, we had the Great American Bash match at 96. I think it was Ray versus Dean Malenko, which was really good. We had the Fantastic Psychosis versus Ray match at, which is a Cruiserweight match at, I think it was Bash at the Beach 96. So there was loads and loads of good matches that people need to check out if they haven't done before. But, yeah, hopefully that answers the question for Wilkie. It was a phantom tournament, very much in the all fake, all rubbish. So yeah, that's basically how that one came about. So I can I'm just about to start my car, JT. Shall I jump on and get on the road?
Yeah, you know what, I think you should, because it is time for our WCW 1-800 Collector Road Report, looking back at this week in WCW history with the chap they call Alan.
The United Center, but tomorrow night we're going to be at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. We've already sent our good friend Lee Marshall there, and he reports in from Milwaukee on the road with 1-800-COLLECT. Lee, are you cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Lou Alcindor as their first pick.
So this is a fairly big one as well from a Nitro history perspective. This is June the 10th, 1996, Nitro from Wheeling, West Virginia. This is the one where Kevin Nash makes his return as Scott Hall's big surprise for WCW. And this is huge. This was kind of what everyone was wondering, who the next guy was going to be. Obviously, any insiders would have known Diesel was leaving or had left at this point. He had been working out a little bit, as we mentioned in the previous show, in the power plant, because he was listed as one of the graduates of the power plant, which makes me laugh. A quick visit there to get shouted out by Buddy Lee, and on he went onto TV. So, yeah, makes his WCW return in June 10th, 96. And this, like I said, was huge. Did you watch this at the time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was tuned in. And I mean, it was pretty much tipped off. Like, they weren't really keeping it much of a secret once Hall showed up, because I think the week before Hall comes on, because there's a week in between Hall's debut and Nash's debut, right? I believe. And so they're not back to back weeks. So Hall, or is it? Is it back to back?
No. I think we discussed this in episode 6, yeah.
Right, because that was May 27th or whatever. So yeah, the week before he comes out and he talks to Bischoff on the podium and he says, like, I'm the medium sized guy and the big guy's coming or something like that. So it was pretty obvious it was going to be Nash, but it was still a great moment, even though Bischoff does his best to ruin it by, you know, Hall comes up and he's getting in Bischoff's face and Bischoff's like, where's your other guy? Where's your other guy? And Nash is standing behind him and like Bischoff, like, this is so obvious. You know what I mean? Like, Hall, like, just keeps pointing and he's like, what are you pointing at? You know, it's just, it wasn't as smooth as it could have been. And then he turns and then he like runs away all awkwardly, but it was a really cool moment. And Nash with the baseball cap on is a lot, but.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. With that baseball cap. And this is the era of Nash with his thumb starting to go into his jean pocket.
Where is it? The big surprise. I mean, I heard a lot of talk, but where's the walk? What? I'm here. Where is it?
You've been sitting out here for 6 months running your mouth. This is where the big boys play, huh? Look at the adjective, play. We ain't here to play.
Yes, it was. It was his into the jean pocket. But it was the, it was also, you know, what helped Nash a lot during this period was that final 4 months in WWF. Like, do you think this would have been as big and he would have seemed as cool if he was coming off, like, say, October 95 versus May of 96? Now, when you look at that 96 run he had where he's fighting The Undertaker, has that great match at WrestleMania 12, even the feud with Undertaker, then he has the brawl with Shawn, he's kind of being a dick on TV from December on. Like, that, to me, parlayed him to be this Kevin Nash. Whereas if he had come in after, like, 95-ish, it wouldn't have seemed... He couldn't have pulled off the cool badass as well. So WWF really did him a favor by giving him this five-month run of just being, a cocky prick that let him just easily transition to being this guy here.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This real kind of cocky guy kind of started when he lost the title to Bret at Survivor Series when, you know, afterwards he powerbombed him. There was a table spot in that match. It was, you know, a really good match, I thought. And then we had the great matches, like you said, in 96 against Undertaker and the match with Shawn In Your House, Good Friends, Better Enemies, where that really great spot with Mad Dog Vachon's prosthetic leg was used. I think that was a really memorable spot there as well. So, yeah, really, really good kind of end of running WWF. And it was where I first heard the term tweener. Mm-hmm. Used a lot, and it was one of the first, probably some examples before, the first kind of mainstream tweener that was on either WWF or WCW TV. You know, we could argue Flair was a tweener to some and others, but one that was kind of pushed specifically in that role.
Right. Yeah, definitely. It was definitely a big tweener role for him. Yeah, I would say he's probably one of the first. I mean, he's in many, many ways the prototype to what, like, a Steve Austin would become, and they try it the next year, too, with Shawn Michaels, where he... when he drops the title to Sid and he kind of gets a little edgier and then they pull back quickly. But it was, you could see the outlines in, I think, what Diesel, you know, what Austin would become. You wonder if they would have done some of that with Kevin Nash if he had stuck around in 96, because he was already starting to do it. He was kind of calling out McMahon as the owner. He was kind of, you know, letting loose a little bit, shooting just a little bit with stuff. So, you know, of course, he had a curtain call in there, but even before that on Raw and shit, the stuff he would say, was shining a little bit of a light. So you do wonder if he would have been the prototype Austin out there, just kind of being the antagonist to the boss and to the corporate office, and eventually turn face again. You wonder how much that could have been him, because he was already starting to be positioned that way, and then boom, Austin does it like however many months later. So it's interesting to see what Nash could have been if he had stuck around.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note as well that Raw this week, you know, in 96, beat Nitro in the ratings. They got 2.7 to Nitro's 2.6. And the reason I mentioned that, it would be the last time Raw beat Nitro in head-to-head ratings for nearly 2 years. Mm-hmm. So this was it. This was the, you know, WCW's dominance started now. And the catalyst was obviously this stuff, the NWO, or the early seeds of the NWO, which we then saw, you know, fully form at Bash of the Beach in 96 when Hogan made his return and his turn. So, yeah, this is a definitely pivotal pivotal point in WCW's history.
Yeah, plus WWF at this time, Raw was very canned. I mean, like, throughout 95, Raw was, you know, kind of blah. But into 96, you have good stuff going on, but they still had those long four-week taping cycles where, you know, the results, if you were in the know, the results were out there pretty quickly. And even the fourth episode of those tapings, the one that was usually before the pay-per-view, like, the idea of a go-home show wasn't very prevalent at that point.
No, it was often very changed a lot now, yeah.
Right, it was often very dark. You know, like that last week of tapings, the crowd didn't seem to give much of a shit, and it just felt very stale being the fourth week in that arena. And they were forced to mix that up. By the end of 96, they were forced to at least start to mix it up and not have as many consecutive weeks in an arena. So they definitely shifted because of the pressure Nitro was putting on them. But, you know, WWF gave them the opening by being so canned and fresh and behind the times. Then once you had this live Nitro, and then boom, Nitro's 2 hours, and then, oh my God, they have this shit going on. It's like, you know, things jump-started very quickly in 96.
Yeah, and I was glad to have been able to watch it all at the time, because this was, you know, fantastic TV from WCW. So shall we jump on to the last question on this week's episode, JT?
I think so. I'm ready to dance.
All right. So is it a nice, easy question, this. What is your favorite WCW themes? And this is from Blue_RayMysterio on Twitter. And his favorite song was the All-Americans theme. So I don't know if that was
the American Males. The American Males.
Oh, sorry, American Males theme. So, yeah, that was from Blue_RayMysterio. So I'll just give you my two favorite WCW themes. And my favorite ones were the WCW, it's the ninth Horseman theme as it's listed. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's on the WCW album, that's the music of WCW album that's out on Spotify and elsewhere. It's the famous Four Horsemen theme with a really good kind of guitar riff through it. Really love that song. Really fits the Four Horsemen characters, especially Arn Anderson, really, really well. And yeah, I really love that theme. I love the piece of music on its own, and I'll listen to it, you know, if it comes on in the car, I'm not just skipping it. It's not one of those themes as well that is obviously a wrestling theme. You could play that and no one would go, what are these stupid lyrics? What's this? It's a cool piece of music. So that's my number one favorite. And my second favorite was Brad Armstrong's WCW theme. You know, it's one of those themes where you can picture yourself driving in your Bentley GT convertible with a mullet and your hair's flowing in the wind as you listen into it, and you know, you're thinking in your head it's gonna be all right, you know, everything's gonna be okay, and then you put your foot down and you drive off into the sunset listening to this theme. So yeah, big fan of the Brad Armstrong theme there as well. So they're my two favorite themes in WCW, JT. So what are some of yours?
Oh, there's so many good ones. I mean, the NWO theme is like iconic, right? I mean, that's one of the best in wrestling history to fit a group or a wrestler. Even Hogan using Voodoo Child, I know it's not an official WCW theme, but at least for like generated there was a real song. But I mean, I thought that was the perfect fit. Man Called Sting was always a favorite of mine. That's a good one. The Natural. I always like Dustin Rhodes, The Natural. I thought that fit him well. Like Vader's second theme, the one where he was with Harley Race as champion, like 93, 94, in that era. I thought that's always been one of my favorites. The Hollywood Blondes theme was always a favorite of mine. And they would use that for a lot of guys after, like just random people that would show up, like Greg Valentine, Marty Jannetty. Like those guys always used like that theme as theirs. I mean, Rey Mysterio, this was pretty iconic too. You know, that was a good one. You can almost picture him when you hear that song just kind of bopping down the aisle to the beat. But there's so many good random ones, like Juventud Guerrera, Psicosis. Like these guys that just throw out there, these random generic beats, they became really, really, you know, tied into the wrestler. And yes, WWF had iconic themes and Jim Johnson and all this other stuff, but WCW, they weren't always lacking in that area. I mean, they had some really good themes that fit their guys, and they were more prone to using generic stock music for a lot of guys, but sometimes that stock music became synonymous with the wrestler, and I thought there's a lot of good ones. I mean, we could probably spend 3 hours on Slam Jam alone, right? I mean, there's so many good ones on there.
Oh, yeah, the ones of Slam Jam, especially Scorpio's theme, which I know Parv's a big fan of. Barry Windham's theme as well, I was a big fan of that. So all the Slam Jam is good fun. It's on YouTube, Slam Jam. I'll put it in the playlist so people can listen to it. But, yeah, it's great. But the other side of this question that I wanted to talk about,
JT.
Mr. Bang
Bang. Yep,
go ahead. Yeah, Mr. Bang Bang with your Cactus Jack. I'm trying to think. Oh, I love Doom's theme as well. Ron Simmons' Doom, the saxophone. We've played this on the show, I think, as one of the outros or intros in the previous episode. So, yeah, they're all fantastic. But the other side of this question, not the question, what I wanted to talk about was WCW and its infamous way of knocking off actual songs and changing a thing here or there to fit a wrestler.
Yes.
You know, one of the most famous examples of this is someone like, I don't know, it was Diamond Dallas Page, really, isn't it? With the knockoff of Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana.
Yeah, and it's funny because when I went to the DDP yoga seminar last year, he starts the workout with Smells Like Teen Spirit, and he says like, all right, everyone should know, or it sounds like the song came on, he's like, if you know, you know. You know, like he kind of winked at like all the wrestling fans that were in the room, kind of because that was the song he started out with. So it was kind of a cool touch to like the people in the know. It was like his little secret with what song he was starting. And I was with my mother-in-law for that workshop, and she asked me after. She's like, what did he mean by that? And I was like, oh, you know, he used the theme as his wrestling theme or whatever. But yeah, there were a ton of them. I mean, there's a lot of them. If you want to go through some here, we can comment on them.
Yeah, there's some that obviously I'm not going to mention them all here because some are not really memorable enough for me to notice. But
right. One
I do remember, and I always thought this was Brian Knobbs' theme. It was a knockoff of My Sharona by The Knack.
Random choice.
Yeah, that was a good one. We had Chris Jericho's second theme, which was a knockoff of Even Flow by Pearl Jam. I thought that Raven had a knockoff one of that as well.
No, he had a knockoff of
Come As You Are, that was it, by Nirvana. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, that was the WC. Yeah. Come As You Are. Yeah. Because his WCW theme was the Keep Him Separated. And then, yes, he comes to WCW. He had much the slower theme. You're right. It was Come As You Are. Yep.
So, yeah, some other ones as well. We had Eddie Guerrero had a knockoff theme of War's Lowrider. That was a song that I used to like to play on Guitar Hero. Lowrider by War.
So that was the LWO theme, right? The dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun. Yeah, so you actually, that was, we closed last week's show with that one, so there you go.
Oh, yeah, and then we had, Chris Canyon had a knockoff of ACDC's You Shook Me All Night Long, which I was a big fan of at the time. Yeah, we had loads and loads of them here. We've got The Outsiders had a knockoff of Seal's Crazy at one point.
Yeah, that was a weird one, that weird first song they had. I think they only had it like at the Great American Bash or whatever. I remember downloading that on AOL and being pissed it wasn't the NWO theme. I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this isn't the song. I feel like they did a lot of these in like that 99 era. One of the favorites I had, and we always joked about this in college at the time, Elix Skipper. Had DMX's Party Up as a knockoff of his theme. Primetime is, you know, it was just like this, it was so fucking obvious, and it was like they weren't even hiding that it was just a straight knockoff. And then one of my other favorite themes is Vertebreaker with Shane Helms. Vertebreaker! K.I.D. started in 91 in the state of NC. Was the exact knockoff of Shimmy Shimmy Ya by ODB. I mean, it's like really bad. It's like the beat is identical. Vertebreaker, we'll break your spine. Vertebreaker, you give me time. Vertebreaker, we'll slap your face. Vertebreaker, break you like a bruiser. And it's just like a vertebreaker instead of Shimmy Shimmy Ya. It is dead obvious what they're using. So I feel like that 99 era, they didn't even try and hide it. Those and Jeff Jarrett's Cowboy ripoff, where it's basically, it sounds the same. It's just like an instrumental version of Cowboy by Kid Rock. I mean, it's those three are like super, super obvious.
Some other ones that I was a big fan of at the time was, and I didn't notice this at the time, but I noticed it a few years ago, York Foundation's theme was basically a ripoff of the theme from L.A. Law, which was big in that era in the early 90s, which made me chuckle a bit when I realized that at the time. We had VK Wall Street had a knockoff of Aerosmith's Love in an Elevator. Which is completely random.
That is another random one. There's so many random ones that they pull out of there. And I know we have this list, and to me, I know it's not on this list, but I am dead sure that Ricky Steamboat's Family Man is a knockoff of Rhythm of the Rain. If you listen to it, it sounds just like it. Dan Fogelberg's Rhythm of the Rain. Go back and listen to it. But yeah, there are so many random ones, especially during the late era and then that early era too, where they pick some really odd choices.
Yeah, just to kind of close this question then, really. The one that is a basic, a complete rip-off, and it's obvious, and they kind of push it as a rip-off, was Prince Iaukea's theme when he was the artist formerly known as Prince Iaukea.
Oh, yeah.
When he was basically Prince, coming out purple. He had, was it Paisley with him, was his
yep.
was his valet, which Paisley is obviously, is that...
Charmel.
What he, Yeah, which was Charmel. Yep. So that was kind of a little rip-off of the Prince kind of vibe at the time. So, yeah, the Purple Rain knockoff, it was so obvious. It was a pretty cool theme anyway. I didn't mind that too much because it was you knew what it was doing.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I mean, there's some... you know, there's some good ones too, even beyond the ripoffs. The NWO B Team was always one of my favorites too. Like, I thought that was a really good one. Just catchy. And there's a ton. I mean, there's a ton. You hear a lot of them. I got a list we're going to play here in and out of all these episodes. So there's so many good songs from WCW. And even if they're not good, they're just memorable. Did you ever hear the Chris Jericho, you know, his first like face theme, that really upbeat one? Did you ever hear the version that had the words to it?
No. I've not heard that, I don't think. I may have done, but not from memory.
That's on YouTube as well. Maybe I'll close the show with that one this week. It's Chris Jericho's first happy-go-lucky babyface theme, but it's got lyrics to it. I don't know if they ever used it or if they used it briefly and then switched off, but it's an odd little song. So I'll find it. I'll close the show this week with it.
Okay, cool. So hopefully that answers the question there for Mr. Blue_Rey Mysterio. Thank you for the question in via Twitter. So if anyone else has got any more questions for us to fill our plunder bucket up, feel free to send them our way. The best way to do that is either via Twitter. You can tweet either myself at Alan_Cheapshot. That's Allan_Cheapshot. Or you can tweet JT at place2 BE Nation. Or you could email the question if you want to do a bit more long form at letters from centerstage@gmail.com. Now, the best way to reach us, any feedback, anything like that. So you've got a few things you want to mention before we wrap the show up, JT, about what's coming up and a few more plugs for some of the Place to Be stuff.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So, you know, as you're hearing this, the PTBN Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever project is running hot and heavy. We have a Facebook group page and we have a thread for every nominee. You know, all the wrestlers that have been nominated by the members of this committee are up there, and the discussion's been tremendous. So we got people sharing matches and sharing thoughts and why people should or shouldn't make the top list of 100, and you know, that says it all. So what we're going to do is everyone who's contributing is going to submit a list of their top 100 WWE wrestlers only of all time, and it can only factor in their WWE career. So you may have a Ric Flair who normally would finish probably 1, 2, 3 or whatever in a greatest wrestler ever type of project. Here, you only factor in his work in the WWF/E, so he's going to drop. So it's kind of unique because it puts a big set of parameters. And we're up to right now 113 people are in this thing. So it should be a lot of fun to do. It's already been a lot of fun. And if you want in on it, you can just hit us up on Twitter or on Facebook or via email. You can reach us and ask for inclusion. We can add you to the Facebook group. If you don't want to be part of the Facebook group, you can still contribute. We have a Google document that has all the rules and all the list of nominees, and you can still put together your own list if you don't want to take part in the conversation. Lists won't be due until the end of the year, to December probably. So there's plenty of time to really do research, and that's what we're encouraging people to do, to watch matches, watch footage, and get familiar with these wrestlers. Don't just go off few memories and really understand and learn. The part of the fun of this project is the journey. So definitely sign up for that if you're interested.
Yeah, I mean, I've only posted a couple of times on it so far. I mean, we've got plenty of time, we've got 6 months or so. I was posting a couple of my favorite Dick Murdoch WWF matches, one of them versus Barry Windham from, I think, 85 it would have been, which is really good. People should check you know, the whole thing out. It's a really good project, really good thing. So I'll be taking part in that. So we've got some other podcasts of yours, JT. I've not had a chance to listen to it yet. I'm not going to lie to you, but there's that one with you're doing with you and your friend who's not a wrestling fan. Do you want to tell the guys about that again like you did last week?
Yeah, be sure to check it out. Jeff Learns Wrestling, episode 3, should have dropped by now by the time you're hearing this. It's fun. My buddy Jeff, who never has been a, we've been friends since high school, but he's never been a wrestling fan until now. We're making him one. We're taking him chronologically since, like, we started in like early 80s, and we're moving through the history of wrestling with him. And we've watched, you know, we started with episode 1. It was just the introduction. We did the Mega Powers angle, and then we went back and did some stuff, you know, in 84 into 85, and episode 3 is all NWA based. So he's learning, and it's been a lot of fun. He's got some interesting questions. You can hear him starting to pick up on trends as we move forward, but still the stuff that shocks him, and the stuff that shocks me, the questions that come out of his mouth as we move along. So it's a lot of fun. It's on the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed on iTunes or placetomination.com. We also have our other feeds, Place to Be Nation Pop and the Pro Wrestling Only. You can subscribe to all of those on iTunes. Leave us ratings, leave us feedback, let us know what's going on out there. As well as, you know, Facebook and Twitter, like Alan mentioned too. We're always open to feedback and, of course, suggestions. So thank you for checking out this show. Anything you want to plug last minute here, Alan, or are you good to go?
No, as well as corrections, we've no problem at all if anyone notices us, you know, not saying something correctly, because we're not going to be perfect. So we're two fans at the end of the day. We try and research as much as we can, but there's so much that WCW did, and, you know, we're not going to get everything right. So stick with us, guys. We try and be as accurate as we can be, and we hopefully you learn one or two things per show when you listen that you may not have realized about the WCW. So as long as we've done that, I think we're happy with what we've done with the show.
Absolutely. So, all right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week. As always, you know, had a great time. And, of course, as we mentioned last week, we're still working on getting Scotty Riggs. He had agreed to come on, so we're just working out scheduling. So if you have questions for Scotty, send them our way. We'll kind of go through his career and his time in WCW and you know, look at the absurdity of it all as well. So for Alan, I am JT. Another week in the books. We'll be back here next week for episode 9. Until then, everyone, take care.
Adios.
Vertebraker.
Yo, baby! Yo, baby! Yo!
At the Mauler, completely maul his opponent, Steve Dahl.
What I've heard.
What's up, shit? No softball game?
Mike Magazine called it the Harvard of professional wrestling.
All right, the Honky Tonk Man is your winner.
One more time. Hey, there's a guy from Deliverance.
Ah! It's not hot!
You red-headed booger, you.
Is it spread?
Yes.
You can't find your scissors?
Wow!